start. I've got three small things I want to discuss, and they're kind of boring, but I've made them like they're future operations. And Chuck is going to follow a much more interesting physics based question, so I'm trying to might have a talk. If you look at how Palat has been taking observations over the last 3 years, the fraction of time that we spend out observing or in pointed mode operations has been steadily increased. So it's now up until August, July of this year, we spent about 6.5% of our time in pointed mode. It's reasonably clear to me that it's quite likely, well, it's very likely that this trend will continue and that the fraction of time we spend in pointed mode will continue to increase, but never dominate because both sonics that we do are observing it. So I have a couple of questions. The first is, has anybody in this room ever noticed or been adversely affected by one of our pointed mode observations?
One of the first pointed mode, it might have been the first pointed mode observation. There was a TPD flare from maybe that just happened to be the case, but it was not the field of view for that flare. So we basically didn't have to expose for a solid that's an example.
Okay. That's actually one example I did already know about. But I think it's useful to discuss them because getting feedback on what works and what doesn't work is can help us decide how best to
Would the data in the anomalous repoints, automatic repoints, they break up like, and so sometimes you find yourself like the peak in May 2009 of PK-10-089, with the last big lake curve that you lost was half day or something like that. On that. So they do disrupt lake curves, and that means you sometimes miss the peak. Or
comments? Yes. So we have a page on the actually this is there a browser on here? There's a place where we ask people to report what multi wavelength observations they're planning to do. And we look at that page when we're scheduling calibrations or considering a target of opportunity observation. So for example, I have to send an email about this. We had a request for a POO to look at the sun. And I went to the multi-wavelength page. I saw that Svetlana had uploaded what looked like a very comprehensive multi-wavelength campaign that was happening right at the time of this POO. And a large fraction of my reason for declining the POO request was that it was going to interrupt something that had clearly put a lot of work together. I can see some real value in expanding that to not just be you've got a large multi-wavelength campaign organized for a particular time, but also that you've noticed something particularly interesting in the data, and it's a flag to us to such an object is high and it's very exciting right now. Please don't interrupt observations for X amount of time. Is that sort of answer?
How long did a typical pointed observation last?
Currently, they're lasting from 2 to 5 days. But I think there's there have been proposals for things like 3-week-long observations that were quite compelling. I think, but for the technical flaw in the proposal would have been accepted.
mention, though, that the pointed observations are not strictly pointed. That there is some sky cover at the same time.
That's true. I mean, not all of the sky gets no exposure, but certainly during a pointed mode observation, some of the sky gets no exposure, and another part of the sky gets little, and one part gets a lot. Where one part is, a lot of the sky, it's, bit of the sky. More comments?
Is there an obvious place on the website where the automatic read points and the pointed observations are listed?
Yes.
So you don't go looking around for data that aren't there?
Ah, web page, perfect. That's the multi-wavelength reporting page. Another place called Go is Observing Timeline. You can go to the Observing Timeline and click on Timeline Posting. You get a list of what we've been doing. So there's just a set of regular observations here if you want to go into it's been a while. Here you see this is the point from an observation that's associated with safe holes that we entered a little while ago. You can see there's some specialized observations. We've been doing a sequence of observations where we look at the neighbor. You can see the atomic root points are also in here. In light of the top, if you want to zoom just to pointed observations, you can see what this is pointed observations here. So you can see we have a PA observation as well. So yes, the answer is yes, there is a place to see what we have done, but what we don't have in a very convenient form is a place to see what's coming up. We internally, we carry about a 3-week planning cycle. So something like 2 to 3 weeks ahead of time, we know what we are going to do. And that's useful for you to know. So if you tell us, 3 weeks ahead of time, we won't even have scheduled a point to note observation. While I'm here, something else I wanted to. Are there any other comments about pointed node observations? Because one of my other reasons for asking this is I think it's important for us to constantly update documentation that describes the pros and cons of pointed node observations so that we can provide appropriate guidance to the peer review panels when they're evaluating proposals. And of course, one of the drawbacks is if your science can be done with survey mode, you're not going to propose to do survey mode because that's the default mode. So we need to know how to say how much crash time should be in survey mode and to get some way to quantify what really is a bad observation for both people who are using survey mode for science. Well, when we're planning a pointed node observation, if it's not a target of opportunity and it's not an ARR, we schedule a slice of sky survey when the target it goes behind the Earth. So you do get reasonable coverage of a large fraction of the sky that way. So in a normal point of node observation, you're actually not even losing complete coverage on that. Only a small fraction of the sky completely loses coverage. Splitting up a pointed mode observation usually doesn't make sense because in many cases the motivation is to get very dense observations either because you want to improve your sensitivity for, say, detecting pulsations or you're really hammering in on something. My inclination is that if somebody proposes a pointed mode observation that says it's okay to split it up and make it more sparse, you're on your way back to survey mode. Anyway, but certainly we never throw any idea off the table. Okay, well, if anyone has any other thoughts on this, feel free to send them in an email to me or Dave or anyone in the science report center. It's certainly something we want to get feedback on, particularly as the number of pointed mode observations are getting more frequent. And in particular, if something you're studying is affected by a pointed mode observation, please let us know, because this is useful information for us to better plan how to commission in the future. So, we word it politely, but complaints are fine. So another, a second item I wanted to discuss is how we handle the multi-wavelength data that's collected in support of Fermi observation. So if you go to the Fermi page and you click on data access, and then you go all the way to the bottom, you see multi-wavelength program supported by supporting Fermi, and there's a list of things. And these are all great. These are all the web pages that you guys have put together to make your results available back to the rest of the community. So I have a question. Has anybody ever actually gone to this page and found this head of links? One person, great. Two. Okay. Is this useful? Do we need to make this more prominent? Okay. And related to that, so that answers that question, that if you find it useful and you haven't, if you think that something like this is useful and you haven't found it, then we need to think through our web page.
Well, we used to have another page, and I don't know whether that worked into this or was
There was a pre-launch page, and it's dangling somewhere on this website. This is certainly the one that is actively maintained, but we certainly need to make this link more prominent, maybe by having a more welcoming multi-wavelength page area.
Well, one thing you could do is use, there's a bunch of surveys on here that get a fair amount of hits. You could email to all those surveys that you know about.
Pass them a link to this, yes. That's an excellent idea. That's much easier than me making our web pages to make it easy to find. Thanks.
We'll be happy to do it.
Great. Perfect. That's the plan. A second item is one of the... When I discuss to review panels the value of the Fermi Depth Investigator Program, I comment that we provide not just gamma ray data to the community, but indirectly through the guest investigator support, we also have data about other wavelengths. And their question is, how many people actually use this who aren't already part of the group made the data in the first place? Do we have that information? So, like for Mojave, for example, are there many examples of people who've used Mojave data that were not initiated by the collaboration? Okay. Perfect. One of the things I'd quite like to do is to try and collect some statistics on that and wrap that into some of the science return from, I think it's not really Fermi's science return, but we have had some stake in this, and I think at least in terms of the science return from the GI program specifically, it may be worth trying to capitalize on it. Do the other groups have something similar? Okay. And so again, if you've got anything to follow up on that, just please send me a note. This isn't much of a discussion because I'm doing all the talking. So my final comment was on the gamma ray light curve. So we've discussed the observations, we've discussed everybody else's data. It does seem to me that we could try and find, in addition to making this particular thing, the easiest thing to make things more public is to make this page be more prominent in the community so more people go there. If we were ambitious, we could think about better ways of compiling, collecting the data so that you could, for example, pick a particular source and see which data from any of these links would apply. Doing that, of course, is going to be real work. I mean, it's not worth doing unless folks think it would actually be useful. So my final point is on the gamma ray light curves. So right now, in terms of publicly available light curves provided by the Institute, there are two options. There's the automated science processing, which is intentionally done promptly as soon as the data come in. So as the underlying analysis changes, those data points are not consistent with one another. So they're not, it doesn't produce a publication quality light curve, but it does serve to give you a snapshot of what might be exciting in the sky. The other place where there's a publicly available light curve on lots of sources is in the published catalogs. Those are on a fairly coarse temporal resolution, but those can be used directly. What more would be useful? I mean, there's extremes. So we're clearly not going to be in a position to produce light curves on all timescales. But is there something simple or easy that we could provide that would make it much easier for you to use the gamma ray data? And gamma ray people, if there's something that you think we could easily provide that you want to suggest. Browse is the way to go. So this is a common question. So the way I do this is go to the browse table, and then you browse this table up here. And then you can select whatever parts of the table you want. But just put in no search criteria,
You'll get back and we'll get the full list. No, I don't think it's obvious at all. I don't know if it's actually happened yet, but there was an intent to make an FAQ question that was how to do this, because it's quite a common need to want to simply be able to browse, to be able to browse sources.
You can cross the world. You didn't have a lot of this, but
well, that might well be. Oh, you mean so just extending 2FGL to add a few more fields that represent each of the monitoring programs, and then you just look at it here. Yeah.
It requires some parallel discussion. Traditionally, radio astronomy
Well, but we're not talking about actually putting data in here. We're just talking about putting a flag to say this is being.
To collect the data, no? Then.
Yeah, that's. I mean, there's obviously the coordinates in here, but. Okay.
I think that for each program,
one snag that I see with this is that the 2FGL is static, but the list of sources that you monitor in any given program is changing its function. Yes. Another way to potentially display or share data, we've put together a bibliography of all papers related to Fermi. The person who put it together assumed that we would want links to the data that was used in each paper and just went ahead and did it. So he, for places where he could find the data, he put it in a directory and assigned a link. But that also points to, in the suggestions that Gino and Benoit were saying, if we did want to define the format to make light curves public, we could attach them to the paper in which they were first published on and have it in a standard format, so that for any paper that contains a lot light curve, you get it in the same way, and perhaps similarly for other observatories.
Each side have a different text messages that are around the table. There are several people that are managing the same kind of data, like cars, in different formats, and find a common format in digital.
So I think thank you very much, everyone. I thank you for this.
So three things to talk about. Try to go to the big picture issues. But let me start. I mean, I think Marcus was excessive saying Kermit about divorce. Jansky or anything. Actually, we have great affection. We Fermi people for Jansky, but you're not the only waveband. Okay, there are lots of other interesting wavebands. And so every now and then we go. We even like astroparticles. What can I say? So what are the three things I would like to just focus on? There's something called Tune's Challenge. So I wrote this big document for SASPE lectures, and Tune actually read the last part of it, where I'm talking about the object that seems to have been missed a lot in our meeting here, but should never be forgotten, which is the black hole, the big black hole sitting at the center of all of our interesting sources. We believe and think it's a black hole. But Tune Kamai, a Fermi guy, asked me, okay, so there's a difference between radio loud and radio quiet properties. There's this almost a prejudice, a perception that this is due to a Blanford's knife process. It's the spin of the black hole that could make for the dichotomy between radio loud and radio quiet. But then how do you demonstrate that? Or is Blanford's knife just a phrase that doesn't have any content? Well, if it's a phrase that has content, then we have to figure out a way to identify the effects of the black hole spin and the formation of jet, if in fact that's actually the reason that some sources are radio loud and some sources are radio quiet. Of course, so our colleagues in the galactic black hole community have a lot to tell us about that. But we have a lot to say in the extragalactic community because we have these massive black holes. They're putting out lots of energy. So how do we know it's a Bradford's knife? Well, in this SASPE document and also in the paper I wrote with Benoit, I speculated, well, one way we can separate the universe into the relaxed and moderate universe versus the extreme universe. And this dividing line is the division between luminosity divided by variability time. And there's this nice index that's been known for probably 30 years, that it's the ratio of the Eddington luminosity divided by the light travel time across the Schwarzschild radius. And that's a nice fiducial separating what I call relaxed and moderate with the extreme universe, because I think that at the long time average, blazars are Eddington limited. There may be episodes where they're not Eddington limited, strong accretion rate. But if that's the case, they're Eddington limited, then they shouldn't radiate absolute luminosity greater than whatever that Eddington is, 47 Hertz per second. So if they're radiating at 10 to the 50 Hertz per second, or at quiescently 10 to the 48, 10 to the 49, and we have a black hole mass estimate, there's this collimation that's required, and that collimation is related to the underlying physics. But this is just one aspect. You can go look in these papers about how I speculate maybe Blanford's knife is related to the spin of black hole, and it's related to the collimation. But there's also black magnetosphere, whether it's a neutron star or black hole magnetosphere, it has certain energy ejection properties. It's a lot different for a neutron star than a black hole, but I think the underlying presumption is the same. It's putting out energy in a collimated form, whether it has to do with a light cylinder in a neutron star paradigm, or if it has to do with the spin of the black hole somehow. But by looking at, what is it that can tell us that Blanford's knife is more than just a phrase? How can we demonstrate that? And I don't know if any of us have any ideas on that point about how to use all this great information you have to determine what the underlying energy deposition mechanism is and wave lines. That's really one of the interesting questions.
So you want to differentiate that with, say, accretion disk.
A pure accretion disk, hydro MHD type modeling, is there a way? Or no, there's a big difference. GRBs could never be a sort of optically thin accretion process. It could be optically thick for us. But I don't know. There's a big difference between extracting energy from the spin of a black hole and extracting energy from the accretion disk.
I don't care what the rotation point is. The difference is mass loading. If you do mass loading from the aerosphere, then you can imagine that not very many particles are going to get in there, and so you can accelerate things to near the speed of light.
But here is still a trick
that
I don't see why
we want mass loading. Well, if you mass load too much, then the magnetic field is not going to accelerate it near the speed of light.
Mass loading is a good parameter in there. I don't see why a black hole. And after all, this black hole is accreting. We see everything else. Other radiation. So while there is an accretion disk, the material, as far as we know, from accretion disk falls into the black hole. So that material has to create some magnetic rewind.
Yeah, but the Blanford Diagram mechanism has a magnetosphere, and the accreting stuff can't get into that magnetosphere.
Clearly, maybe different type of collimation field. In the case of magnetic field from the accretion disk, and in the case of magnetic field from spinning black hole.
There are two sources of energy, and they're probably highly coupled about the mechanisms to extract them. Unfortunately, it makes it hard to distinguish the two. But we do know that there are these different types of AGNs, and so there's a natural presumption of the black hole. But it's hard problem, but we should keep that in mind.
Yeah, I think there hasn't been enough of a theoretical dichotomy.
Okay, so let me just make a point.
That everyone agrees on.
But now we know that the black hole has not spin up strictly through supermassive coalescence events. So this is what the narrow line deeper of one galaxy is telling us. Telling me anyway. There was this presumed sort of demography and genealogy that you have merging spirals, making ellipticals, the gas kind of dissipates, but you fueled you had a coalescence event which could have increased the spin of the black hole and then it gets dissipated. But now that we see these narrow line deeper one galaxies, which we don't think because they're spirals, they haven't gone through any sort of strong coalescence, clearly. They may have some tidal interactions. So you can spin up black holes. That's what tells me if you make this presumption that the black hole spin power is a jet. So. Okay, and there obviously there's a lot more to be said. So number two, unification and evolution. We're going to be talking more about that tomorrow. And there's this whole issue of we look at individual sources, and you can see them in the subparsec scale, the milliard second scale, and VLDI. But at larger scales, you have the FR1, FR2 characterization, and you have space densities of FR1s and FR2s. Now we can get space densities of all these radio galaxies. This is a game that's been played by Mark Schmidt years ago. But Mark has put up all the famous Urey and Padovani thing, which took place 16 years ago, was published. That needs to be redone. I mean, we have all this new data. So does unification really hold? I mean, the space density of FR2s is about 1,000 per cubic gigaparsec, maybe 100 per cubic gigaparsec. It depends on what limiting flux you're talking about. And it's larger for FR1s, but if you relate that to some beaming factor and then the space density of BLX and FSRQs, does this stand in our expectation of unification paradigm? And with Paolo Grandi, we're starting to look at that problem too, but I don't think enough attention has been paid, again, to unification after Fermi's been up now in its fourth year. radio side, we need to revisit this whole issue. Our, you know, you can say the words almost by heart, FO1s and VLAC objects, FO2s, aspect ratios, is that true? Are the radio galaxies the parent population? And how do they evolve? And again, this is the redshift evolution question. Do the VLACs evolve in the plasma point closure? If they're not, they're separate populations. And we'll again, this is premature to go into that because we're going to talk about that tomorrow. But this is another big, more big picture issue, I think we all think.
So there's 97% of the sources are 2 dots or whatever. And there's a different number of invalidants. And they don't change, they didn't change from 1 dot to 2 dots from the law. But there's such a small population of people on the internet. But something very important that is to qualify about the open internet. Okay, but obviously it's lots of open sense. Okay, number three, let's see, what was that, Department of Energy? Location, of course. Location, location, location. beloved by real estate agents and astrophysicists everywhere, where are the gamma rays coming from? And, you know, I was pretty close-minded about gamma relevant during the days. It had to be in the broadline region. But there are certain new observations which make it impossible to ignore that very likely in some systems. And so it takes place in the parsec scan, gamma rays.
The thing that we radio people don't like about that is that the theorists didn't believe it when we just showed all this radio data on it. They only believed it when they found they couldn't get a TV photon down. That'd be a theoretical reason, not the radio reason.
That's a good point. I don't know why TV photons. But no, I was also, obviously, when you see the change in the optical polarization angle, you can play games. Maybe there's some sort of magnetized accretion disk that's changing its state. It's harder for a TV photon to get out of a region. It either gets attenuated. So,
if you see one beam in the output and gamma radio, it represents the peak at the same day. How it can come from both lines?
So of course
it is not. It was a very well sampled.
Being a theorist, I would just confuse the issue. I mean, you say that it either happens here or it happens here, but I mean, you know, all the energy has to
occur here. It has to be formed. The engine is in the, at the black hole. And then we're talking about energy deposition, extraction. It's generated at the black hole, but it's deposited at the location. And there are many ways to deposit it. You could have a 40 plus outflow, like Al was referring to, that sort of approach where it's has no baryon loading, you know, it's almost purely 20 plus, and then maybe it could decelerate, but you also have an acceleration.
As far as referring to, you also have an opacity problem not only for TED photons, but also an opacity problem for millimeter photons.
For millimeter photons.
Oh, I see.
Yes, you have millimeter photons. You cannot see millimeter photons there.
True, but you know, I look at all these light curves. For every light curve you put up, some of which are very convincing, and there are some others that's a bit from which you can draw the opposite. So that's what makes it difficult.
So I understand that it is difficult to explain why we have this break in 3D for 5.43. Why we have a break?
It is
not
absorption. I know.
So,
or even made in the broad language. It's easier to mind.
How do you know your stacking didn't come in the break anyway?
Yeah, it's true. It is possible. Yeah, it is possible. But it is easy, very easy answer. Because why it should be this break? It's possible that it comes this break.
Maybe Pedro has more to say about that. But
I'll come up with it.
It's the constant dominance portion of the energy density of the surrounding radiation divided by the target equipment density square. But that energy density is lower in the molecular core. Rupesh, if you can get Marcos on some. Because to do justice to your thing, you should actually go through the equation. But I just worked it out with Marcos. But I don't think it's as good as it is. But let me just wrap up because I know we're all hungry. Okay, so we've been doing all these correlations between light curves, and I agree that's important to find the underlying radiation acceleration physics. But I think when you're doing it with radio, radio has this whole hysteresis, the whole history of everything that's happened is coming out. And so what would be nice, I mean, and since we have only the 1 month light curves, we should be comparing the longer light curves with generic rises and falls, not the short vestibule light curves. It seems to me, if you can, since we have 1 month average, now you can just compare if you have 1 month average radio light curves.
What's the bias in what we're saying? A particular behavior that is repeats from other objects, then it's worthwhile. But if you have a particular behavior that follows 10% of the objects, and then you have another behavior, another 10% of the objects, and so on and so forth, then it's kind of puzzling thing, at least for, or the next question is that what really we should spend the time on, or maybe we should try to do something different, something about it?
Then that's a choice each of us makes
yeah.
for ourselves. I'm not going to suggest. But this is an important aspect of the puzzle, too. I mean, I don't think anyone here doubts the large-scale view that you have some jet of outflow and you have some acceleration taking place. But you know, if you're going to understand these light curves, you have to start with the model. And you think we have a model, but then the light curves become... Well, we can't find some simple underlying, I mean, just to come up with a lag. I guess I hear that you see the lags in FSRQs, but not in VLACs, depending on your frequency. And it's a rather murky issue. And we depend on everybody to bring to shed some light in it.
Maybe we're not doing an effort to find the Well, these are like children. You know, there's some family resemblance, but they all have their own individual behavior.
Okay, but I mean, I'm sure we see achromatic variability, but when there's a whole range of light curves at different frequencies, generically you can see it's highly variable at the short wavelength, and then it becomes weakly variable, just as what we expect in some sort of cooling scenario, acceleration and cooling scenario. But after that, it becomes much harder to say anything concrete. But
your final comments, seeing the gamma hold back.
So,
I'm going to say that this is, I really don't want to stop this amazing question. I don't want anyone to go hungry.
Sure.
So, we will.
We have two more then.
Yeah, hold your thought, and we have a lot of informal discussions about it. We're trying to get smart. Let's go and have dinner, and then, you know, relax, and see you tomorrow morning at 10 to 9.